It is Monday, July 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, the top diplomats of the U.S. and Cuba meet in Washington to mark their nation's formal resumption of relations. We'll tell you what their priorities are. We'll find out which U.S. businesses hope to gain from access to the Cuban market. And Israeli environmentalists say a new nature park in Jerusalem can be a model for sustaining urban wildlife.
Gazelle Valley Park is the largest project that we have been involved in Israel's history. If this succeeds, there will be many more. If we fail, it might be the last one.
It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, it was something that you don't see in Washington every day, the flag of a foreign nation rising outside a newly reestablished embassy. That flag belonged to Cuba, which formally resumed full diplomatic relations with the United States on Monday after a break of more than 50 years. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins was at the flag-raising ceremony this morning outside the Cuban embassy, and they asked her what the atmosphere was like.
Well, the Cuban embassy is located on 16th Street, and it was a very, very enthusiastic crowd that gathered to watch the flag raising. As the Cuban flag was hoisted outside of the embassy, people chanted, "Viva Cuba, Viva Fidel." It was a very mixed crowd outside. There were diplomats and invited guests that were inside of the grounds at the gated mansion that now serves as the embassy. Outside of the gate, there were well-wishers and a variety of normalization supporters and opponents. Many of them waved signs and banners. Some waved banners that called for an end to the U.S. trade embargo on Cuba. I spoke to some of the onlookers. One man from Cuba praised normalization but said he was critical of the Castro regime. He said Cubans deserved freedom, freedom to organize, freedom to demonstrate, and freedom to invest. Another onlooker was critical of the Obama administration, saying it had basically turned a blind eye to Cuban injustices. He said it was wrong for the U.S. to make what he called concessions to Cuba when there were human rights concerns. He also said the U.S. should not have been so quick to remove Cuba from its state sponsor of terrorism list.
Well, some of those issues may have come up a few hours later in a meeting between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Cuban counterpart Bruno Rodriguez. I understand you were at the State Department for that meeting. What were the main points that they made?
Well, they had several main points, and I had an opportunity to ask Foreign Minister Rodriguez if during his private discussions with Secretary of State Kerry, if they'd set priorities for future talks, and I also asked if he envisioned a political opening in Havana on issues such as greater freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and the legalization of opposition parties. He called these internal matters for Cuba, but he did say that during his talks with Kerry, he emphasized Cuba's desire to have the trade embargo lifted and also the Cuban desire for the return of Guantanamo Bay. Secretary of State Kerry, for his part, said that along the way, as the normalization process between the two countries continues, they are sure to encounter bumps here and there and even what he called moments of frustration. Kerry said that patience would be required, but he said that was all the reason to get started on what he called the journey now.
And did Secretary Kerry give an indication of what policy goal the U.S. wants to achieve first in its relationship with Cuba?
He didn't say what goal he wanted to achieve first. He did mention that they discussed a wide variety of concerns, some of those being human rights concerns that the U.S. has about Cuba. He also spoke about the two country broadening ties as far as trade and investment is concerned.
All right, our State Department correspondent, Pam Dawkins, thanks very much for that report.
Thank you.
Well, let's see what social media are saying about the restoration of U.S.-Cuba relations. International Edition's Giabi Lee is in the studio to tell us about two Twitter accounts related to the normalization of ties between the two countries. Hey, G, what's going on?
Hi, Michael. It is a historic day for the United States and Cuba. And of course, America's top diplomat John Kerry has been tweeting and retweeting a lot this Monday. His original tweets and retweets from the State Department's main Twitter account are all in English, but he also shared tweets from the official Spanish language account of the State Department. Kerry's on Twitter at John Kerry.
Right. So what did Kerry say in his original tweets today?
Well, Kerry has three original tweets today, and the one that got the most attention is the first one. He wrote, "On August 14th, it will be my honor to raise the American flag at our embassy in Havana, hashtag Cuba, for the first time in 56 years. And he ended the tweet with hashtag US Cuba. More than 17,000 people retweeted that, and it's also been marked as a favorite nearly 2,000 times. He sent out the tweet about 5 hours ago, so the numbers are definitely going to go up.
Got it. Now, what is the reaction from the Cuban side on social media?
It showed a similar sentiment. The Cuban embassy in the States is on Twitter at EmbaCubaUS, that's EmbaCubaUS. The tweets are in English. It actually changed the handle several hours ago and added a new description to reflect the reopening of the embassy.
That seems like an appropriate move. Mm-hmm. So did that account send out any tweets today?
Oh, yes, it did. There are two. One is announcing the handle change to at EmbaCubaUS, like I just mentioned. And another tweet is a photo of Cuban officials visiting the embassy in D.C.
Okay, so before we let you go, what are the trending hashtags on this topic?
The social media analytics website Topsy shows that hashtag USCuba, the one that John Kerry used, was used in more than 9,700 tweets in the last 24 hours. And Michael, as you know, Topsy is a certified Twitter partner that analyzes tweets.
Yeah, it's the one we always follow. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much, G. Abby Lee. That was our G. Abby Lee. And you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
This is Green Bee for a healthier planet.
The bees at the Fairmont Waterfront Hotel are welcome guests. But unlike the other guests at this Vancouver resort, the bees didn't come to relax. They make honey and help pollinate the hotel's large herb garden. Bee butler Michael King is enthusiastic about his charges because of their capability to pollinate most of the world's agriculture.
Their ability to navigate, their ability to feed themselves, their ability to feed us as a result of what they do.
The Fairmont Waterfront Hotel is a green hotel, certified by Green Key Global, an environmental group that specializes in the hotel industry. There is complimentary parking for electric vehicles, and guests are served the honey produced on site. The hotel also promotes sustainability with its rooftop garden, which helps save rainwater and insulates the interior of the building. The hotel says it's on a mission to be certified zero waste by the end of next year through reusing, repurposing, and recycling. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Well, the process of normalizing relations between the U.S. and Cuba only begins with today's formal opening of embassies in Washington and Havana. Both nations still must overcome legal obstacles to the free flow of information, people, and trade. My colleague Jeffrey Young spoke earlier with analyst Thomas Bilbao of the Washington-based Cuba Study Group and asked him what the United States stands to gain from removing those obstacles.
Opening embassies puts us in a position to advance U.S. natural interests on the ground in Cuba. It allows our diplomats to have greater contact with civil society on the ground and with diplomatic missions there, and to work with Cuba on a number of bilateral issues that are of mutual interest, like drug interdiction, oil spill mitigation, and terrorist financing.
Tell me about the work that's going to have to be done on Capitol Hill.
Well, while we opened embassies, we know that the embargo is still in place, and that's because that was codified by Congress, and it takes Congress in order to do away with those sanctions. For example, Americans' ability to travel to Cuba for tourism is something that's explicitly prohibited in law. However, there is legislation to do away with that travel those travel restrictions, and there are other legislation in place to expand telecommunications, to wholesale lift the embargo, or to expand trade in different areas. So it will take Congress moving to do away with those sanctions.
You know, for decades, big developers, they've been looking at Cuba and they've had big eyes and a big appetite. All they see is Condo Canyon. All they see is development. How long do you think it's going to take?
I think that what we should concentrate on doing now is helping Cubans start, operate, and grow their businesses and let them be the authors of their future. And I think the United States and the U.S. business can play an important role, but I think that the future of Cuba should be led by the Cuban people, not by us.
What about laws that have to do with property, with investment, with protecting people's development? Every country has to have laws to protect investments. Are Cuba's laws on the books, presently on the books, strong enough to encourage investment and development, or do they need to be beefed up so that Cuba becomes a more attractive place for outside money?
Well, we've already seen that there are foreign investors in Cuba, and Cuba, in fact, redid its foreign investment law last year to try to attract new businesses, and it did attract some, but I think that a lot of companies still have very legitimate concerns, including the ability to hire and manage their own staff, to be able to pay their staff directly, a number of labor concerns, and concerns regarding property and the protection of intellectual property and other things that really will have to be resolved if Cuba hopes to attract the type of foreign investment that it needs to grow its economy to be able to be competitive in the 21st century.
That was analyst Thomas Bilbao speaking to International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Well, U.S. property developers aren't the only businesses here that want to jump into the Cuban market. Earlier, I spoke to International Edition's Alexis Christophorus in our New York bureau, and I asked her which other U.S. industries want access to Cuban consumers.
Well, Michael, there are high hopes on the part of many, many different companies chomping at the bit to get a piece of this newly opened Cuban market. Companies involved in tourism are sure to see a huge boost in business. I'm talking about cruise companies, airlines, even hotel chains that are looking to do business there. But outside of tourism, well, you've got internet service providers who want to be able to bring their services into Cuba, like Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn. U.S. banks see tremendous opportunity there as they will try to get business from both institutions and individuals. Auto companies also stand to benefit, as does telecommunications companies, which now will be able to create infrastructure in Cuba that will open up a communication pipeline between the two countries. It's estimated only about 5% of Cubans have access to the open internet, so there's a huge potential there.
Moving on to the gold market, I understand that gold prices fell quite sharply today. What is driving down gold prices?
Yeah, they lost a little more of their luster today. Prices fell to a five-year low. Traders are abandoning the precious metal because they're betting on the first U.S. interest rate hike in 9 years. Fed Chair Janet Yellen has signaled quite strongly that rates in the U.S. would start to rise possibly later this year because of the improving U.S. economy. And that sent commodities investors heading for the exits because most commodities are priced in U.S. dollars. And that makes them more expensive for overseas buyers when the dollar gains in value, and that's what we're seeing now.
And then one other item on the business list today is PayPal. That company listed on the NASDAQ today. What kind of response was there from the market?
A very warm welcome from investors, Michael. PayPal returned to Wall Street in style. It used to be a publicly traded company, then was not when it got swallowed up by eBay. But shares of the e-commerce company was spun off from eBay, jumped as much as 11% in their return to the NASDAQ. And with that kind of pricing, it values PayPal at more than $50 billion. Hard to believe, but that's where Wall Street pushed the stock today.
All right. Alexis Christophorus in our New York bureau. Thank you for that update.
You're welcome.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Professional astronomers with help from amateur stargazers have discovered a fascinating binary star system some 730 light years away from us in the Draco constellation. This two-star system contains a very hot and dense white dwarf that is actually devouring its larger companion star by stealing its gas. The scientists say that the white dwarf's mass is so dense that a teaspoon of material from it would weigh as much as an elephant. Another factor that sets this star system apart from others is that it contains a large amount of helium but no hydrogen, which is very strange since hydrogen is the most common element in the universe. The University of Cambridge-led team made their findings by analyzing data gathered in 2014 by the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite, along with additional observations made by a collective of amateur and professional astronomers. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Israeli environmentalists say a new Jerusalem nature park they helped to create can help other cities and countries learn how to sustain wildlife in urban settings. Gazelle Valley Park opened in late March in the western part of Jerusalem, surrounded by residential neighborhoods and highways. It's home to endangered mountain gazelles, reptiles, and birds. I recently visited that park and spoke to activists who fought an almost two-decade-long battle to establish it. The battle began with defeating a plan by property companies to redevelop the area, and it ended with the activists securing municipal approval and funding to preserve the valley as a nature park. Well, one of the activists I talked to was Amir Balaban of the Society for the Protection of Nature in Israel. He told me that he hopes Gazelle Valley Park will be a model for Israel and the world.
We have to enhance nature, and in order to do so, we're involved in a few very important stages. The first one is to create a national database of urban wildlife in all Israeli cities. The second one is to create master plans of urban wildlife sites and urban wildlife in cities all over Israel, and we're doing this in cooperation with the Ministry of Environment. The third aspect is the physical aspect, creating these natural anchors in each town, a network of urban wildlife sites that, first of all, protect local biodiversity, second, enhance them and use the biodiversity services that they supply, and the third element is education and community, using nature to create strong community, healthy communities, people who care about their environment. So Gazelle Valley Park is the largest project that we have been involved in Israel's history. If this succeeds, there will be many more. If we fail, it might be the last one. Now, looking around us, there's a lot of urban wildlife in other countries around us. In Cairo, the magnificent Nile passes through Egypt's capital. In Baghdad, it's the Euphrates. It's an immense force. Now, we have a lot to benefit in these cities from wildlife and working with nature. And one of the amazing things we see here in Israel, and we'll see it when we walk and stroll in the park, you will see people from very different backgrounds spending time patiently in one place. You'll see ultra-religious people, and you'll see ultra-secular people and Arabs just enjoying nature, doing their own thing, but with a lot of patience. So maybe I'm naive, but I believe that nature is very soothing, and it's the best common denominator. And I'm not the only one. One of the first urban wildlife sites created in Israel, the Jerusalem Bird Observatory, which is by the Israeli parliament, held the first ringing course for Palestinian, Jordanian, and Israelis together. So there might be a startup here. And we did this with the help of Merck, USAID, which identified as a potentially powerful tool to bring people together and focus on the really important. So I'm a strong believer that it's not only an important thing for cities, it's very important for people in this region.
Well, that was Israeli environmentalist Amir Balaban. You can find a video version of this story that I filmed myself on voanews.com, along with a more detailed web story about what makes the park unique. Click on the Middle East section of the website and look for the article titled Gazelle Valley, Jerusalem Park Aims to Host Nature and Coexistence. Well, British singer Hannah Bolan is about to release her first CD after making a splash in the United Kingdom. International Edition's David Byrd tells us more about Bolan's CD, The Bolan Affair.
Wrap me up in your arms, read the future in my bones. Tell me if we'll work out, my body's riddled with doubt.
Hannah Bolin says she is fond of music she calls cinematic soul. Think the theme from Goldfinger or The Spy Who Loved Me. Big arrangements, big voices, female voices that showcase big emotions. The 25-year-old from Leicestershire, England, started her first band when she was in elementary school. Obsessed with the Spice Girls, her favorite one being Posh Spice, also known as Victoria Beckham, she formed a girl group of her own and performed original material for her classmates. Bolin left home at 16 to go to a musical theater school, but found she didn't want to do other people's music her whole life. As her career path came into sharper focus, Hannah decided to record as an independent artist. something that has made her rise to success tougher.
I've had lots of friends and family, when you tell someone you're a singer, and they go, oh, got the X Factor. But for me, firstly, I love the writing process. That's a big part of it for me, and I want to have control of what I'm doing. And secondly, I don't think anyone would like me. So I wouldn't get any votes.
But she is getting noticed. After years of gigging with whoever would take her, Boleyn has found success supporting artists, including James Morrison, Joan Armatrading, and Tini Tempa. In working on her debut CD, Boleyn worked with Ash Howes, who's worked with Ellie Goulding, One Direction, and Olly Murs. She also worked with Paul Berry, the writer responsible for Cher's Believe, as well as hits for Rod Stewart, Enrique Iglesias, and others. But her single, Tough Love, is about how difficult it has been as an independent artist, particularly as a woman.
It has been, and continues to be, a massive challenge, but I'm really lucky that I'm now working with some incredible people, and you rely on those people to bring you back up when you're feeling down, and vice versa. So I feel like I'm getting there. Fingers crossed.
Many of Boleyn's songs, including her first single, When You're Gone, are about romance, love, and relationships. She says she loves the emotion of music, so things that spark her emotions inspire many of her tunes.
I'm really influenced by relationships and trying to put a different spin on things as well, looking at things from someone else's perspective.
Tough Love is the second single from Boleyn's debut CD, The Boleyn Affair, which is scheduled for release from Tudor Gate Records in October. I'm David Byrd.
And that's Hannah Boleyn closing out our international edition for today. Thank you to director Tracy Carter and engineer Zahra Abuzaid. I'm Michael Lippin. You can find me on Twitter at @Michael_Lippin. And the show is on Twitter, too, at @VOA_IE. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Iraqi government has announced it is leading a major military push to retake Iraq's Anbar province from ISIL, which controls two of the province's major cities, Ramadi and Fallujah. Clearing ISIL from Anbar is no easy task. As President Barack Obama recently noted, ISIL has dug in among innocent civilian populations in the urban areas under its control. But as local forces take on ISIL militarily, it is also important for ISIL sympathizers in Iraq, Syria, and beyond to hear the stories of those who were once attracted to the propaganda promulgated by ISIL, but who have come to reject it. As President Obama has said, to ultimately defeat terrorist groups like ISIL, it is necessary to discredit their ideology, the twisted thinking that draws vulnerable people into their ranks. Who can do that better than those who have seen it from the inside at close quarters? Take, for example, a former ISIL fighter from Fallujah known as Hamza, who volunteered to join ISIL last summer, but who defected after 6 months. He told the Independent newspaper he joined the group for religious reasons, but was appalled by the beheadings, by being asked to execute Sunnis whom he knew, and by being offered captured young Yazidi women for sexual pleasure. At the beginning, I thought they were fighting for Allah, but later I discovered they were far from the principles of Islam, he said. The justice they were calling for when they first arrived in Fallujah turned out to be only words. Or the Syrian teenager Youssef Barho, recruited by ISIL to be a suicide bomber, who eventually gave himself up to Iraqi authorities. He told the New York Times last year he joined ISIL willingly because he believed in Islam and had been convinced by ISIL that if he didn't join the group, Shiites would come and rape his mother. Soon, however, he said, I noticed things that were different from Islam. He noted, for example, that ISIL inflicted severe punishments on men in the city who were caught smoking cigarettes. Yet in camp, he saw fighters smoking. He witnessed homosexual encounters between the fighters, and he became increasingly disturbed by the killing of innocent people. President Obama has said that the international fight against ISIL is a battle against terrorists who distort Islam and whose victims are mostly Muslims. Those who have experienced ISIL firsthand and have turned away say the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Thank you.